Is Philosophy a Way of Knowing? The second talk at Gutenberg College's 2012 Summer Institute, What the Bleep Can We Know?, was presented by David Crabtree on July 12, 2012. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I have the choice of either talking three times as fast as I usually do or leaving out some stuff, and I can't talk three times as fast as I do, so I'm going to try to truncate this a little bit. But then I'm not sure exactly how this will work out. I'll try to make this as short as I can. That may eat into the question and answers. It probably will. And we'll deal with that when we get to it. If I were to ask you what you think about with respect to philosophy, can philosophy know? My guess is that you would have kind of a mixed response. That is, on the one hand, philosophy has historically and probably should provide some answers to the questions that we have in life. But on the other hand, philosophy seems to be esoteric, abstruse, and irrelevant to all important issues. That would be roughly my response. I think that's the way I think about philosophy as I encounter it today. And this is particularly colored by philosophy in more recent times. Where modern philosophy tends to be the more impenetrable kind. Mortimer Adler wrote a book called How to Read a Book, and in that he talks about how to read philosophy. And he makes a distinction between two different kinds of philosophy. One kind of philosophical work deals with what he calls first-order questions, that is, what happens in the world and what should we do? Those are the first-order questions of philosophy. Other works focus on what he calls second-order questions. What happens when we address first-order questions? And what happens when we try to express such thought in language? So philosophy has branched off and pursued these second-order questions about the method of philosophy. He concludes this. This distinction between first-order and second-order questions is useful because it helps to explain what has happened to philosophy in recent years. The majority of professional philosophers at the present day no longer believe that first-order questions can be answered by philosophers. Most professional philosophers today devote their attention exclusively to second-order questions, very often to questions having to do with the language in which thought is expressed. That is all to the good, for it is never harmful to be critical. The trouble is the wholesale giving up of the first-order philosophical questions, which are the ones that are most likely to interest lay readers. In fact, philosophy today, like contemporary science or mathematics, is no longer being written for lay readers. Second-order questions are, almost by definition, ones of narrow appeal. And professional philosophers, like scientists, are not interested in the views of anyone but other experts. And in his description of this change that's happened in philosophy, he dates it back to the early 1900s. I have an alternate and less charitable explanation for what has happened in philosophy, and I think it goes back further. We just read a piece of a dialogue by Plato, and it may strike you as an odd genre, an odd writing style of writing philosophy. It may strike you as being an odd discussion. There may be customs and cultural things that you aren't familiar with that seem strange to you. But it is accessible and it is relevant to everyone. And this was largely true of all philosophy until I'll call modern times. And what I mean by modern times is the modern era, and that's going back to about roughly 1600. I took just a few sentences. I took these at random, almost at random, from Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. This was published in 1807, and I kept it mercifully short. The good was supposed to be that which has an implicit being, to be opposed to what is. But the in itself, taken in its real and true sense, is rather being itself. The itself is, in the first instance, the abstraction of essence in contrast to reality. But abstraction is precisely what is not true, but exists only for consciousness, which means, however, that it is itself what is called real, for the real is that which is essentially for another, or is being. But the consciousness of virtue rests on this distinction between the in itself and being, a distinction which has no truth, etc. Was that what? Let me see. I'm looking for periods. There are two periods in this. Now, I chose this at random, and there's a sense in which this is not fair, because it's, first of all, it's a translation, and secondly, it's out of context. If it were in context, you would have a chance of building up the vocabulary that he's using and all that sort of thing. But nevertheless, it would be tough sledding to work your way through that. So you see the kind of thing that I'm referring to. What happened in modern times? Philosophers began to speak only to the initiated. This phenomenon that occurred, I liken to something in my experience. So I'll describe this thing in my experience as an illustration. I worked for a year in a medium security institution for juvenile delinquents. I was a counselor in one of the cabins. And that meant that I spent most of my time playing ping pong. And so I would be playing ping pong with one of the inmates, and there was one day when, as we were hitting the ball back and forth, it just turned out that one of us, and I can't remember which one it was first, just hit the ball at the other person. And the other person responded by hitting it back at me. And we just started hitting it back and forth at each other. And we thought that was kind of fun. So the next day, we'd start playing ping pong using the table. You start on the table, but eventually one would take the opportunity to just hit the ball at the other person, and the other person would try to hit it back. And before long, what we discovered is we could start with the table, but the table became irrelevant once we started hitting it back and forth at each other. So we'd kind of move around the room, hitting it back and forth at each other. What's interesting to me is we transformed the game of table tennis into who knows what, but it wasn't table tennis. It was a different kind of activity. It evolved into a different kind of activity, and it even had different goals. Whereas when we were playing table tennis, that was a competitive activity. We were trying to better the other one. But as soon as we lifted it off the table and we're doing this other thing, it was only fun if it was cooperative and we could keep it going. I think that phenomenon is what has happened in philosophy. That at some point, philosophy evolved out of primarily trying to clarify the issues of truth, and probably to a large extent, in a way that was unconscious for the participants, it became an activity in which philosophy was designed to impress. It is interesting. I don't know much about Hegel and his character, what kind of a person he was, but it is interesting that in the time of Hegel, he became like a rock star, that when he would give lectures in a town in Germany, people would stop what they were doing and flock to hear him speak. He gained widespread notoriety throughout Europe. And so we're entering into a time in history when you can make a name for yourself by doing philosophy. And when that happens, then it begins to take a different flavor. But historically, back in its origins, philosophy means love of wisdom, that there was a different kind of project at its heart. Now, I don't want to leave the impression that philosophy there was ever a time when philosophy was without the tendency to want to impress. I suspect that's always been there. But when we're talking about Socrates, we're talking about Aristotle, you sense a different spirit there. It's not primarily to impress. They're trying to sort things out. They're trying to figure out wisdom, trying to figure out, and largely the questions revolve around ethical issues. How ought we live our lives in the light of what is true? I think I got this from Mortimer Adler. Unfortunately, I was looking for books where I could verify this, but all my books are packed in boxes and I can't find the books that I want to find. But I think it was Mortimer Adler who made this point, and I have found it very helpful, that philosophy, a kind of pure and helpful philosophy, is an attempt to use common human experience to shed light on the problems that face us all. It's trying to explain everyday life. Everyday life experience is the way that we, as human beings, all experience it. And how do we make sense of that? Drawing upon the experience that we all have. If that's what philosophy is doing, then it becomes highly democratic in the sense that every one of us can read what the philosopher has written, and we can stand in judgment over it. Does it make good sense or does it not? Because we all have access to the information that they're working from. It's common human experience. And we can all use the tool that they're using, and that is sound reasoning. And the question is it sound? I'm going to, just very briefly, I'm going to shorten this up, but I'm going to use one example to illustrate this point. This is a sample I'm going to be referring to, a work by David Hume and then something by Thomas Reed. We used this in a previous Summer Institute, but if this is already familiar, I'm sorry, but I think it will have illustrative value. The issue that they're dealing with is what happens when I see something. When I look at that chair, what's happening? Now, there are a lot of different ways that question could be explored. All of those would be valid kinds of exploration, and we will be looking at those over the next two days. We could look at it artistically, that is to say, what is my imaginative response to what I see? I remember watching a program for children on what is art, and they gave the illustration of, and they used a chair as an example, and they set a chair out in the middle of the room, and the artist said, I'm curious as to how I could depict that chair as if I were walking around it, as if I were walking around the chair. And so he depicts the chair in a kind of a contorted, twisting fashion in order to capture that concept. So he's imaginatively dealing with the question of what is happening when I look at that chair. It can be looked at scientifically. What is happening molecularly? What is happening? What are the light waves doing? What's happening in my optic nerve, et cetera, et cetera? That would be a different kind of exploration. It can be looked at theologically in the light of revealed truth. What are the implications of what I see for my relationship with God? So there are different ways in which that one question can be approached, but to approach it philosophically is dealing with how do I explain the experience of seeing this chair. Hume's explanation, the way he describes it, is when I look at a chair, I perceive it. That's the word he uses. I perceive it, and that creates an impression on my organ, on my eye. And that impression is what I will call a chairlet. It's not a chair, but it's an impression of the chair. It's a little chair that's there, so we'll call it a chairlet. And as long as I'm looking at that chair, then the chairlet remains vivid in my mind. Once I stop looking at it, then it begins to fade. And Hume says, then it passes into either the memory, we remember that impression, or into the imagination, where we combine it with other impressions, with other ideas. Once we stop looking at it, it changes from an impression to an idea and is captured by the memory or the imagination. Then reflection, when we're thinking about things, that's the process whereby we recall those ideas and combine them in various ways. So that's his explanation of what's happening when we look at a chair. And other sense perceptions are similar. This has some important implications. First of all, I have no way of knowing the relationship between chairs and chairlets. What my mind works with is chairlets. It does not work with chairs. I don't know for sure there's anything out there. All I know is that there's a chairlet on my eyeball. Since I don't know, I don't even know that the world is out there. All I have is these perceptions. He goes on to argue that even cause and effect is something that I don't know exists. I can't see it. Cause and effect is just a habit my mind develops in understanding, in making sense of the perceptions that I have. He uses the example of a billiard ball. If a billiard ball hits another billiard ball, that second one moves. If I keep doing that, my mind starts to put those together. Aha, I know what'll happen if I roll it again. The other ball will bounce off. Is there cause and effect? I haven't seen it, but I have seen this conjunction. I have seen this frequent, consistent coincidence. And I developed the habit of thinking of that in terms of cause and effect. Okay. Thomas Reed rejects this explanation. He says that this is kind of the culmination of a project that began with Descartes, when Descartes was trying to reach the point of certainty of knowledge by sitting in a room and calling everything into question, including his own existence. And Thomas Reed argues that was a failed project. He says, a man that disbelieves his own existence is surely as unfit to be reasoned with as a man that believes he is made of glass. There may be disorders in the human frame that may produce such extravagancies, but they will never be cured by reasoning. So what Reed is observing, and this is very perceptive, and that is you can't doubt your existence. You can sit in your room and you can approximate a psychological feeling that is doubting your existence, like you would doubt something else. But you can't really doubt your existence, because as soon as you go out of that room, you're going to assume that you exist. You can't live life without assuming that you exist. We all assume that we exist. And his argument is, that's what needs to be explained. Why do we assume that we exist? And what he argues is that is common sense. That is an assumption that everyone has, and we cannot exist without it. It's just built into our makeup. So then he tries to explain perception, having rejected the explanation of Hume. And for clarity, Reed switches from sight to touch is his prime example of perception. And with touch, it is clearer, it is more obvious that when I touch something, if I touch the chair, it is not chairlets that I am perceiving. Rather, it's qualities. I'm perceiving hardness, I'm perceiving roughness, I'm perceiving cold, I'm perceiving hot. That's the nature of the sensation of touch. But what is happening when I touch is I'm getting certain sensations, but those sensations are in a language, what he calls a natural language. But he argues that what exists in life, in reality, is this natural language by which things communicate to us. So when I touch a chair, there's a certain sensation, and my brain takes that sensation and says, translates it, and says, I know what that means. That means rough. Or I touch it, and those sensations, my brain says, I know what that means, cold. That the sensation itself is not the quality itself, but is that quality put into natural language that my brain is able to understand. So for him, there are three important implications from this perspective. The first is that there is a natural language in the world through which things out there can communicate to us, that things communicate fairly reliable, and our brain is capable of translating those communications fairly reliably. That's the first. The second, our senses are telling us about something that's really out there. The chair that I feel is really out there. It's not just impressions. And third, cause and effect are not just our imagination. They are real, even though we cannot see them. We are hardwired to search them out and to find them. Okay, I use that example because Hume's explanation is on the face of it plausible, but Reed levels a very good objection to it, and that is, we can't really doubt that things are out there. It's just not compatible with human existence. Then Reed is driven to find another explanation, and one that I think ultimately makes more sense. It is interesting that if Reed were to ask the question, what justifies this assumption that there is a world out there that seems to be designed to be known, and that we as human beings seem to be designed to be knowers and to know that thing that is out there, it requires some kind of coherence. It requires, in all probability, a God, some kind of maker. And I think that Reed suspected that that's what the skeptics were nervous about, coming up with a system that was dependent upon that truth. Reed goes into great detail, and I will skip that whole section where he talks about philosophy as it's being demonstrated by the skeptics, and saying, if that's philosophy, I want nothing to do with philosophy, because that's headed down a road that has that's a dead-end street. But philosophy rightly understood, Reed has great confidence in it. He says, I'll just read one quote, but it is absolutely certain that this fair lady, that is philosophy, is of the party, I'm sorry, but is it absolutely certain that this fair lady is of the party? Is it not possible she may have been misrepresented? Have not men of genius in former ages often made their own dreams to pass for her oracles? Ought she then to be condemned without any further hearing? This would be unreasonable. I have found her in all other matters an agreeable companion, a faithful counselor, a friend to common sense, and to the happiness of mankind. This justly entitles her to my correspondence and confidence till I find infallible proofs of her infidelity. Okay, so can philosophy know? And this, I'm referring to philosophy in the sense of the understanding that I gave you from Mortimer Adler, that is, that it's based on common human experience and in its attempt to make sense of common human experience. What's absolutely philosophy can know, but is best suited to sorting out our common human experience? What skills and knowledge must a philosopher have? No special skills, just a disciplined mind. No special knowledge, just years of human experience. But it does require certain qualities, and I'll list three of them. Persistence. the issues of life are such that they are not easy to sort out. Second is patience. Answers do not come quickly and easily. And third, humility, because we are all prone to making mistakes. And these questions are difficult questions. They're hard to sort out. It's hard to know when you have found an answer that adequately accounts for all for human experience. I would argue that we are all philosophers. We have to be philosophers. To one degree or another, we have to be philosophers. The issue is, are we good ones or are we bad ones? Years ago, I remember talking to someone about philosophy and the importance of sorting out the central issues of life, the ones that Casey listed on the board and others. And this person said, I don't have time for philosophy. And I was thinking about that because at the time we had young children, and I was thinking, for me it's kind of just the opposite. My most philosophical moments came when I had to change diapers in the middle of the night. That it's the reality of human existence and coping with it that forces us to be philosophers. It's not philosophy can be done in a study, but the best philosophy, I think, is done in the midst of coping with life and sorting with the questions that present themselves as we're coping with life. And in that sense, I think we can't avoid but be philosophical. The only question is, will we be good or bad? That's basically what I had to say. Do we have a little bit of time for questions? We've got a little bit of time for questions. Thomas. R-E-I-D. Reed, is that not right?
In the movie that I only watched part of, a very short part of one of the things that there was a guy there talking about how when you do a PET scan on a brain and you see what part of the brain lights up when you look at an object, and then you have the person imagine the object and the same parts of the brain light up. So he concluded the brain can't tell the difference between a memory and actually looking at something. And I think that was about the time I was, shortly after that, I turned off the movie because I thought, oh. But to that person that I would want to say, well, if you ask the person, are you remembering something or are you looking or doing something else, looking at something, not remembering something, can they tell the difference? If they can, then the brain can tell the difference between. I mean, just because the same things light up when you remember it as opposed to that. I mean, there's any number of explanations for that that don't have anything to do with the brain can't tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing he must have been going in the same direction that Hume was going. The idea that
he's concluding the same.
That
yeah.
There isn't really.
I would think that Hume would embrace that experiment.
So the lesson from that, I guess, is when you abandon first principles, it's like an artist trying to make a piece of art and saying, but I must not use any paints, I must not use any brushes, I must not use any pencils or anything like that. You're essentially cutting your legs out from underneath you because the tools that you need in order to do what you're trying to do are gone. By definition, you have abandoned them. Does that sound like a good critique?
Well, here's the way I would think about it. I don't think Thomas Reed would have any difficulty with that experiment either, the data that they received from the experiment. He could explain it just as well as Hume could. So both of them would say, great. What's interesting is that scientific approach, it can't answer the question, what is this experience of seeing? It can answer a certain part of that question. It can tell you what is the biology and chemistry that's going on there, but that's not going to answer the question, what is the phenomenon of vision or sense perception? And that's true of most questions. That is, that most questions, in order to be answered adequately, need to be approached by a variety of these disciplines, that science can contribute to can contribute something to answers to some of these questions. Art can contribute something to the answers to some of these questions. Theology can contribute something, and philosophy can contribute something. But they're all different avenues of human reasoning that need to be drawn upon in order to offer a confident answer to these questions. So what I would say is the scientist thinks he can do more than he can do. At least that scientist was thinking he could do more than he could do with his avenue of inquiry.
So not recognizing the limitations of science.
Exactly. Anything else? We've worn you out.